Lee, they won't be able to come in the dark. So if anything happens in the dark, we're goners. You mentioned that you expect the weather to clear up later in the day. What more can you tell us about that? The swell size is supposed to go down to 5 to 8 meters, and the winds come around to the east, 25 to 35 knots. So that will take a lot of the edge off the fear I have right now, which is of sustaining a direct hit. If we take a direct hit and the boat goes over, and we take another hit, the boat goes down. And we're all shored up here. Everything is battened down, hatched, and practically nailed shut. If she goes over, there's no way anybody's going to get out. Over. Now, is there a point where you may have to abandon ship, and is the crew and yourself prepared for that eventuality? Well, to tell you the absolute truth, I don't think the crew is very prepared for an emergency. They have no emergency beacon and don't seem very up on their emergency procedure, which is a little frightening. I'm the only one who has a survival suit, but in a swell like we have today, it wouldn't do me much good. Yeah, right. Well, listen, I thank you for talking to us, and the whole of the province is praying for your safe return. Thank you. With that, Reeves turns back to the business at hand. After talking to Tommy Barry, Billy is probably able to steam northwest another 2 or 3 hours before the seas get too rough to take on his stern. That would place him just north of Data Buoy 44139 and on the edge of Bonkero, one of the old fishing grounds off Nova Scotia. The 200-fathom line turns a corner at Bonkero, running north up the St. Lawrence Channel and south-southwest to Sable Island. About 60 miles due east is an underwater canyon called the Gully, and then the Sable Island shallows start. Sable Island is a 20-mile sandbar that extends another 40 or 50 miles east-west below water. From a distance, the surf that breaks on the shoals looks like a white sand cliff. Mariners have headed for it in storms, thinking they might save themselves by driving their boat onto the beach, only to be pounded to pieces by 20-foot waves on the outer bar. Sable Island historian George Patterson writes in 1894, "From the east end, a bar stretches northeasterly for 17 miles, of which the first 4 are dry in fine weather, the next 9 covered with heavy breakers, and the last 4 with a heavy cross sea. The island and its bar present a continuous line of upwards of 50 miles of terrific breakers. The currents around the island are terribly conflicting and uncertain, sometimes passing around the whole circuit of the compass in 24 hours. An empty cask will be carried round and round the island, making the circuit several times, and the same is the case with bodies from wrecks." The island prowls restlessly around the Scotian shelf, losing sand from one end, building it up on the other, endlessly, throughout the centuries. Since 1873, it has melted away beneath the foundations of 6 lighthouses. Herds of wild horses live on the island, the descendants of tough Breton mountain horses left there by the French. Nothing but marin grass holds the dunes in place, and cranberries, blueberries, and wild roses grow in the inland bogs. The Gulf Stream and the glacial Labrador Current converge at Sable, frequently smothering the island in fog. 5,000 men are said to have drowned in its shallows, earning it the name the Graveyard of the Atlantic, and at least that many have been pulled to safety by life-saving crews that have been maintained there since 1801. We have had a tolerable winter, and no wrecks except the hull of the schooner Juno of Plymouth, one island keeper recorded in 1820. She came ashore without masts, sails, or rigging of any description, and no person on board except one dead man in the hold. In bad weather, horsemen circled the island looking for ships in distress. If any were spotted, The horseman rushed back for the surfboat and rowed out through the breakers to save anyone who was still alive. Sometimes they were able to fire rockets with a line attached and rig up a breeches buoy. After the storm died down, they'd salvage the cargo and saw the ship timber up for firewood or construction material. People pulled from sinking ships often spent the entire winter on the island. Sometimes 200 or 300 people would be camped out in the dunes, waiting for a relief ship to arrive in the spring. Today, there are 2 lighthouses, a Coast Guard station, a meteorological station, and several dozen oil and natural gas wells. There's a 60-foot shoal 30 miles to the northwest and a 45-foot shoal 20 miles to the east. They mark the western and eastern ends of the sandbar, respectively. Billy isn't right on top of the bars yet, but he's getting close. In the old days, it was known that most shipwrecks on Sable occurred because of errors in navigation. The westerly current was so strong that it could throw boats off by 60 to 100 miles. If Billy has lost his electronics, his GPS, radar, and Loran, he's effectively back in the old days. He'd have a chart of the Grand Banks on the chart table and would be estimating his position based on compass heading, forward speed, and wind conditions. This is called dead reckoning. Maybe the currents and the storm winds push Billy farther west than he realizes, and he gets into the shallows around Sable. Maybe he has turned down sea on purpose to keep water out of the wheelhouse, or to save fuel. Or maybe their steering's gone, and like the Asian Maru, they're just careening westward on the weather. Whatever it is, one thing is known for sure. Around midnight on October 28th, when the storm is at its height off Sable Island, something catastrophic happens aboard the Andrea Gale. The Zero Moment Point. Behold, a pale horse, and his name who sat on him was Death, and Hell followed with him. Revelation chapter 6, verse 8. In the 1950s and 1960s, the U.S. government decided to detonate a series of nuclear devices in the Pacific Ocean. The thinking was that deep water would absorb the shock wave and minimize the effect on the environment, while still allowing scientists to gauge the strength of the explosions. But an oceanographer named William Van Dorn, associated with the Scripps Institute in La Jolla, California, warned them that a nuclear explosion in the wrong place could convert the entire continental shelf into a surf zone. Concerned, the Navy ran a series of wave tank tests to see what kind of stresses their fleet could take. They'd already lost 3 destroyers to a typhoon in 1944. Before going down, the ships had radioed that they were rolling through arcs of 140 degrees. They downflooded through their stacks and sank. The Navy subjected model destroyers and aircraft carriers to various kinds of waves and found that a single non-breaking wave, no matter how big it was incapable of sinking a ship. A single breaking wave, though, would flip a ship end over end if it was higher than the ship was long. Typically, the ship would climb the wave at an angle of 45 degrees, fail to gain the top, and then slide back down the face. Her stern would bury itself into the trough, and the crest of the wave would catch her bow and flip her over. This is called pitch-poling. Ernie Hazard was pitch-poled on George's Bank. It's one of the few motions that can end ship-to-shore communication instantly. Another is a succession of waves that simply drives the boat under. Founders, as mariners say. The dictionary defines founder as to cave in, sink, fail utterly, collapse. On a steel boat, the windows implode, the hatches fail, and the boat starts to downflood. The crew is prevented from escaping by the sheer force of the water pouring into the cabin. It's like walking into the blast of a fire hose. In that sense, pitchpoling is better than foundering, because an overturned boat traps air in the hold and can stay afloat for an hour or more. That might allow members of the crew to swim out a doorway and climb into a life raft. The rafts are designed to inflate automatically and release from the boat when she goes down. In theory, the EPIRB floats free as well and begins signaling to shore. All the crew has to do is stay alive. By the late hours of October 28th, the sea state is easily high enough to either pitchpole the Andrea Gale or drive her under. And if she loses power, a clogged fuel filter, a fouled prop, she could slew to the side and roll. The same rule applies to capsizing as to pitchpoling. The wave must be higher than the boat is wide. The Andrea Gale is 20 feet across her beam. But even if the boat doesn't get hit by a non-negotiable wave, the rising sea state allows Billy less and less leeway to maneuver. If he maintains enough speed to steer, he beats the boat to pieces. If he slows down, he loses rudder control. This is the end result of 2 days of narrowing options. Now the only choice left is whether to go up sea or down, and the only outcome is whether they sink or float. There's not much in between. If the conditions don't subside, the most Billy can realistically hope for is to survive until dawn. Then at least they'll have a chance of being rescued. Now it's unthinkable. In violent storms, there is so much water in the air and so much air in the water that it becomes impossible to tell where the atmosphere stops and the sea begins, writes Van Dorn. That may literally make it impossible to distinguish up from down. In such conditions, a helicopter pilot could never pluck 6 people off the deck of a boat. So for the next 8 hours, the crew of the Andrea Gale must keep the pumps and engine running and just hope they don't encounter any rogue waves. 70-footers are roaming around the sea state like surly giants, and there's not much Billy can do but take them head on and try to get over the top before they break. If his floodlights are out, he wouldn't even have that option. He'd just feel a drop into the trough, a lurch, and the boat starting up a slope way too steep to survive. 70-foot seas? I'd be putting on my diapers at that point, says Charlie Reed. I'd be quite nervous. That's higher than the highest point on the Andrea Gale. I once came home from the Grand Banks in 35-foot seas. It was a scary fucking thought. Straight up, straight down, for 6 days. My guess is that Billy turned side to and rolled. You come off one of those seas cocked, the next one comes at a different angle, it pushes the boat around, and then you roll. If the boat flips over, even with everything dogged down, water's gonna get in. The boat's upside down, the plywood's buckling, that's the end. When Ernie Hazard went over on George's Bank in 1982, the motion wasn't a violent one so much as a huge, slow somersault that laid the boat over on her back. Hazard remembers one wave spinning them around and another lifting them end over end. It wasn't like rolling a car at high speeds. It was more like rolling a house. Hazard was 33 at the time. 3 years earlier, he'd answered a newspaper ad and got a job on the Fairwind, a lobster boat out of Newport, Rhode Island. The storm hit on their last trip of the year, late November. The crew were all good friends. They celebrated the end of their season at a steakhouse and then left for George's Bank late the next morning. The winds were light, and the forecast called for several more days of fair weather. By dawn, it was blowing 100. We were driving the boat well. You point the boat into the sea and try to hold your own until it blows out. Stay there, take your pounding. You balance the boat, flood the tanks, try to save what you have on deck. There was the typical howling of wind in the wires, and there was a lot of foam because of the wind, yellow foam, spindrift. We'd lose power on the waves because they were more foam than water. The propeller just couldn't bite. It happened quick. We were close to the edge of the continental shelf, and the seas were getting large, starting to break, cresting. I remember looking out the pilot house, and this monster wave came and broke over the bow and forced us backwards. There was nothing to hold us there, and we must have dug the stern in and then spun around. Now we're in a full following sea. We never went more than one more wave when we buried our bow in the trough and flipped over. There was the wave breaking, and then a sensation of the boat turning, and the next thing I knew we were upside down, floating inside the boat. I happened to surface in a small air pocket, and I didn't know if I was upside down or standing on the walls or what. I made a dive into the pilot house, and I could see some light. It could have been a window or a porthole, I don't know. And when I got back up into the wheelhouse, there was no more air. It was all gone. I was thinking, this is it. Just take a mouthful of water, and it's over. It was very matter-of-fact. I was at a fork in the road, and there was work to do. Swim or die. It didn't scare me. I didn't think about my family or anything. It was more businesslike. People think you always have to go for life, but you don't. You can quit. For reasons that he still doesn't understand, Hazard didn't quit. He made a guess and swam. The entire port side of the cabin was welded steel, and he knew if he picked that direction, he was finished. He felt himself slide through a narrow opening, the door, a window, and suddenly he was back in the world. The boat was hull up, sliding away fast, and the life raft was convulsing at the end of its tether. It was his only hope. He wriggled out of his clothes and started to swim. Whether the Andrea Gale rolls, pitch pulls, or gets driven down, she winds up, one way or another, in a position from which she cannot recover. Among marine architects, this is known as the zero-moment point, the point of no return. The transition from crisis to catastrophe is fast, probably under a minute, or someone would have tripped the E-perb. In fact, the E-perb doesn't even signal when it hits the water, which means it has somehow malfunctioned. In the vast majority of cases, the Coast Guard knows when men are dying offshore. There's no time to put on survival suits or grab a life vest. The boat's moving through the most extreme motion of her life, and there isn't even time to shout. The refrigerator comes out of the wall and crashes across the galley. Dirty dishes cascade out of the sink. The TV, the washing machine, the VCR tapes, the men all go flying. And seconds later, the water moves in. When a boat floods, the first thing that happens is that her electrical system shorts out. The lights go off, and for a few moments, the only illumination is the frenetic blue of sparks arcing down into the water. It's said that people in extreme situations perceive things in distorted, almost surreal ways. And when the wires start to crackle and burn, perhaps one of the crew thinks of fireworks. Of the last 4th of July, walking around Gloucester with his girlfriend and watching colors blossom over the inner harbor. There'd be tourists shuffling down Rogers Street and fishermen hooting from bars, and the smell of gunpowder and fried clams drifting through town. He'd have his whole life ahead of him that July evening. He'd have every choice in the world. And he wound up sword fishing. He wound up, by one route or another, on this trip, in this storm, with this boat filling up with water, and 1 or 2 minutes left to live. There's no going back now. No rescue helicopter that could possibly save him. All that's left is to hope it's over fast. When the water first hits the trapped men, it's cold but not paralyzing, around 52 degrees. A man can survive up to 4 hours in that temperature if something holds him up. If the boat rolls or flips over, the men in the wheelhouse are the first to drown. Their experience is exactly like Hazard's, except that they don't make it out of the wheelhouse to a life raft. They inhale, and that's it. After that, the water rises up the companionway, flooding the galley and berths, and then starts up the inverted engine room hatch. It may well be pouring in the aft door and the fish hatch, too, if either failed during the sinking. If the boat is hull up, and there are men in the engine room, they're the last to die. They're in absolute darkness, under a landslide of tools and gear, the water rising up the companionway, and the roar of the waves probably very muted through the hull. If the water takes long enough, they might attempt to escape on a lungful of air. Down the companionway, along the hall, through the aft door, and out from under the boat. But they don't make it. It's too far. They die trying. Or the water comes up so hard and fast that they can't even think. They're up to their waists, and then their chests, and then their chins, and then there's no air at all. Just what's in their lungs, a minute's worth or so. The instinct not to breathe underwater is so strong that it overcomes the agony of running out of air. No matter how desperate the drowning person is, he doesn't inhale until he's on the verge of losing consciousness. At that point, there's so much carbon dioxide in the blood and so little oxygen that chemical sensors in the brain trigger an involuntary breath, whether he's underwater or not. That is called the breakpoint. Laboratory experiments have shown the breakpoint to come after 87 seconds. It's a sort of neurological optimism, as if the body were saying, holding our breath is killing us, and breathing in might not kill us, so we might as well breathe in. If the person hyperventilates first, as free divers do, and as a frantic person might, the breakpoint comes as late as 140 seconds. Hyperventilation initially flushes carbon dioxide out of the system, so it takes that much longer to climb back up to critical levels. Until the breakpoint, a drowning person is said to be undergoing voluntary apnea, choosing not to breathe. Lack of oxygen to the brain causes a sensation of darkness closing in from all sides, as in a camera aperture stopping down. The panic of a drowning person is mixed with an odd incredulity that this is actually happening. Having never done it before, the body and the mind do not know how to die gracefully. The process is filled with desperation and awkwardness. So this is drowning, a drowning person might think. So this is how my life finally ends. Along with the disbelief is an overwhelming sense of being wrenched from life at the most banal, inopportune moment imaginable. I can't die. I have tickets to next week's game. It's not an impossible thought for someone who's drowning. The drowning person may even feel embarrassed, as if he squandered a great fortune. He has an image of people shaking their heads over his dying so senselessly. The drowning person may feel as if it's the last greatest act of stupidity in his life. These thoughts shriek through the mind during the minute or so that it takes a panicked person to run out of air. When the first involuntary breath occurs, most people are still conscious, which is unfortunate, because the only thing more unpleasant than running out of air is breathing in water. At that point, the person goes from voluntary to involuntary apnea, and the drowning begins in earnest. A spasmodic breath drags water into the mouth and windpipe, and then one of two things happen. In about 10% of people, water, anything, touching the vocal cords, triggers an immediate contraction in the muscles around the larynx. In effect, the central nervous system judges something in the voice box to be more of a threat than low oxygen levels in the blood and acts accordingly. This is called laryngospasm. It's so powerful that it overcomes the breathing reflex and eventually suffocates the person. A person with laryngospasm drowns without any water in his lungs. In the other 90% of people, water floods the lungs and ends any waning transfer of oxygen to the blood. The clock is running down now. Half conscious and enfeebled by oxygen depletion, the person is in no position to fight his way back up to the surface. The very process of drowning makes it harder and harder not to drown, an exponential disaster curve similar to that of a sinking boat. Occasionally, someone makes it back from this dark world, though, and it's from these people that we know what drowning feels like. In 1892, a Scottish doctor named James Lawson was on a steamship bound for Colombo, Sri Lanka, when they ran into a typhoon and went down in the dead of night. Most of the 150 people on board sank with the ship, but Lawson managed to fight his way out of the hold and over the side. The ship sank out from under his feet, dragging him down, and the last thing he remembers is losing consciousness underwater. A few minutes later, the buoyancy of his life vest shot him to the surface, though, and he washed up on an island, and lived to write about his experiences in the Edinburgh Medical Journal. He attributed the clarity of his recollection to the preternatural calm of people facing death. It's as close as one is going to get to the last moments of the Andrea Gale. All afternoon, the hammering of the big seas on the doomed vessel went on, whilst night came only to add darkness to our other horrors. Shortly before 10 o'clock, three tremendous seas found their way down the stokehole, putting out the fires, and our situation was desperate. The end came shortly before midnight, when there was a heavy crash on the reef, and the vessel was lying at the bottom of the Straits of Formosa in under a minute. With scarcely time to think, I pulled down the life belts, and throwing two to my companions, tied the third on myself and bolted for the companionway. There was no time to spare for studying humanity at this juncture, but I can never forget the apparent want of initiative in all I passed. All the passengers seemed paralyzed, even my companions, some of them able military men. The stewards of the ship, uttering cries of despair and last farewells, blocked the entrance to the deck, and it was only by sheer force I was able to squeeze past them. Getting out on deck, a perfect mountain of water seemed to come from overhead, as well as from below, and dashed me against the bridge companionway. The ship was going down rapidly, and I was pulled down with her, struggling to extricate myself. I got clear underwater and immediately struck out to reach the surface, only to go farther down. This exertion was a serious waste of breath, and after 10 or 15 seconds the effort of inspiration could no longer be restrained. It seemed as if I was in a vice, which was gradually being screwed up tight until it felt as if the sternum and spinal column must break. Many years ago, my old teacher used to describe how painless and easy a death by drowning was. Like falling about in a green field in early summer. And this flashed across my brain at the time. The gulping efforts became less frequent, and the pressure seemed unbearable, but gradually the pain seemed to ease up. I appeared to be in a pleasant dream, although I had enough willpower to think of friends at home, and the sight of the Grampians, familiar to me as a boy, that was brought into my view. Before losing consciousness, the chest pain had completely disappeared, and the sensation was actually pleasant. When consciousness returned, I found myself at the surface and managed to get a dozen good inspirations. land was about 400 yards distant, and I used a bale of silk and then a long wooden plank to assist me to shore. On landing and getting behind a sheltering rock, no effort was required to produce copious emesis. After the excitement, sound sleep set in, and this sleep lasted 3 hours, when a profuse diarrhea came on, evidently brought on by the seawater ingested. Until morning broke, all my muscles were in a constant tremor, which could not be controlled. Several weeks later, I was sleeping in a comfortable bed, and late in the evening, a nightmare led to my having a severe struggle with the bedroom furniture, finally taking a header out of the bed and coming to grief on the floor. Lawson guesses that laryngospasm prevented water from entering his lungs when he was unconscious. The crew of the Andrea Gale either have laryngospasms or completely inundated lungs. They are suspended, open-eyed and unconscious, in the flooded enclosures of the boat. The darkness is absolute, and the boat may already be on her way to the bottom. At this point, only a massive amount of oxygen could save these men. They have suffered, at most, a minute or two. Their bodies, having imposed increasingly drastic measures to keep functioning, have finally started to shut down. Water in the lungs washes away a substance called surfactant, which enables the alveoli to leach oxygen out of the air. The alveoli themselves, grape-like clusters of membrane on the lung wall, collapse because blood cannot get through the pulmonary artery. The artery has constricted in an effort to shunt blood to areas of the lungs where there is more oxygen. Unfortunately, those don't exist. The heart labors under critically low levels of oxygen and starts to beat erratically, like a bag full of worms, as one doctor says. This is called ventricular fibrillation. The more irregularly the heart beats, the less blood it moves, and the faster life functions decline. Children who have proportionally stronger hearts than adults can maintain a heartbeat for up to 5 minutes without air. Adults die faster. The heart beats less and less effectively until after several minutes there's no movement at all. Only the brain is alive. The central nervous system doesn't know what's happened to the body. All it knows is that not enough oxygen is getting to the brain. Orders are still being issued. Breathe, pump, circulate, that the body cannot obey. If the person were defibrillated at that moment, he might possibly survive. He could be given cardiopulmonary resuscitation, put on a respirator, and coaxed back to life. Still, the body is doing everything it can to delay the inevitable. When cold water touches the face, an impulse travels along the trigeminal nerve to the central nervous system and lowers the metabolic rate. The pulse slows down, and the blood pools where it's needed most, in the heart and skull. It's a sort of temporary hibernation that drastically reduces the body's need for oxygen. Nurses will splash ice water on the face of a person with a racing heart to trigger the same reaction. The diving reflex, as this is called, is compounded by the general effect of cold temperature on tissue. It preserves it. All chemical reactions and metabolic processes become honey slow, and the brain can get by on less than half the oxygen it normally requires. There are cases of people spending 40 or 50 minutes under lake ice and surviving. The colder the water, the stronger the diving reflex, the slower the metabolic processes, and the longer the survival time. The crew of the Andrea Gale do not find themselves in particularly cold water, though. It may add 5 or 10 minutes to their lives. And there is no one around to save them anyway. The electrical activity in their brain gets weaker and weaker until, after 15 or 20 minutes, it ceases altogether. The body could be likened to a crew that resorts to increasingly desperate measures to keep their vessel afloat. Eventually, the last wire has shorted out. The last bit of decking has settled under the water. Tyne, Pierre, Sullivan, Moran, Murphy, and Shatford are dead. The World of the Living. The sea had kept his finite body up, but drowned the infinite of his soul. He saw God's foot upon the treadle of the loom and spoke it, and his shipmates called him mad. Herman Melville, Moby Dick. Albert Johnston, 50 miles south of the tail on the Mary T, gets hit a few hours after the Andrea gale, but just as hard. The first sign of the storm is a massive amount of static over the VHF, and then the wind comes, 30, 40, 50 knots, and finally it tears the anemometer off buoy number 44138. The buoy is about 50 miles northwest of Johnston's position and pegs 56 knots before flatlining at the bottom of the chart. Wind speeds above the interference of the wave crests are probably half again as high. The center of the low slides past Johnston late on the 28th and continues curving back around toward the coast throughout the next day. That motion spares Johnston the worst of the storm. It also, as far as he's concerned, spares him his life. Johnston jogs into the wind and seas until night falls, and then turns around and goes with it. He doesn't want to take the chance of running into a rogue wave in the dark and blowing his windows out. Throughout the early hours of October 29th, he surfs downwind on the backs of the huge seas, following a finger of cold Labrador current, and when dawn breaks, he turns around and fights his way northward again. He wants to gain enough sea room so that he won't hit the Gulf Stream when he runs south again the following night. On the second day, the crew fight their way onto the deck to check the fish hold and lazarette hatches and tighten the anchor fastenings. The sun has come out, glancing dully off the green ocean, and the wind screams out of the east, setting the cables to moaning and sending long streaks of foam scudding through the air. Radio waves become so bogged down in the saturated air that the radar stops working. At one point, an unidentified Japanese sword boat appears out of nowhere, searchlight prying into the gloom, and passes within a few hundred yards of the Mary T. On the steeper seas, she can't get her bow up in time and plunges straight through the wall of water. Nothing but her wheelhouse shows, and then slowly, unstoppably, her bow rises back up. The two vessels pass by each other without a word or a sign, unable to communicate, unable to help each other, navigating their own courses through hell. Except for that one expedition on deck to check the fish hold, the crew keep to their bunks, and Johnston stays bolted to the wheelhouse floor, wrestling the helm and jotting down notes in the ship log. His entries are terse, bullet descriptions of the unending chaos outside. Northeast, 80 to 100 winds came on as we passed through west side of I, he records on the 29th. Seas, 20 to 30 feet. Dangerous storm to move east, 15 knots. Become station. Drift southwest and merge with grace. Johnston is one of the most meteorologically inclined captains of the Sword Fleet, and he's been keeping a weather eye on Hurricane Grace, which has been quietly slipping up the coast. At 8 a.m. on the 29th, Grace collides with the cold front, as predicted, and goes reeling back out to sea. She's moving extremely fast and packing 80-knot winds and 30-foot seas. She's a player now, an important, if dying, element in the atmospheric machinery assembling itself south of Sable. Grace crosses the 40th parallel that afternoon, and at 8 p.m. on October 29th, Hurricane Grace runs into the Sable Island storm. The effect is instantaneous. Tropical air is a sort of meteorological accelerant that can blow another storm system through the roof. And within hours of encountering Hurricane Grace, the pressure gradient around the storm forms the equivalent of a cliff. Weather charts plot barometric pressure the way topographical maps plot elevation, and in both cases, the closer together the lines are, the steeper the change. Weather charts of the Grand Banks for the early hours of October 30th show isobaric lines converging in one black mass on the north side of the storm. A storm with tightly packed isobaric lines is said to have a steep pressure gradient, and the wind will rush downhill, as it were, with particular violence. In the case of the storm off Sable Island, the wind starts rushing into the low at speeds up to 100 miles an hour. As a NOAA disaster report put it blandly a year later, the dangerous storm previously forecast was now fact. The only good thing about such winter gales, as far as coastal residents are concerned, is that they tend to travel west to east offshore. That means their forward movement is subtracted from their wind speed. A 70-knot wind from a storm moving away at 20 knots effectively becomes a 50-knot wind. The opposite is also true. Forward movement is added to wind speed. But that almost never happens on the East Coast. The atmospheric movement is all west to east in the mid-latitudes, and it's nearly impossible for a weather system to overcome that. Storms may wobble northeast or southeast for a while, but they never really buck the jet stream. It takes a freakish alignment of variables to permit that to happen, a third cog in the huge machinations of the sky. Generally speaking, it takes a hurricane. By October 30th, the Sable Island storm is firmly embedded between the remnants of Hurricane Grace and the Canadian High. Like all large bodies, hurricanes have a hard time slowing down, and her counterclockwise circulation continues long after her internal structures have fallen apart. The Canadian High, in the meantime, is still spinning clockwise with dense cold air. These two systems function like huge gears that catch the storm between their teeth and extrude it westward. This is called a retrograde. It's an act of meteorological defiance that might happen in a major storm only every 100 years or so. As early as October 27th, NOAA's Cray computers in Maryland were saying that the storm would retrograde back toward the coast. 2 days later, Bob Case was in his office watching exactly that happen on GOES satellite imagery. Meteorologists see perfection in strange things, and the meshing of three completely independent weather systems to form a 100-year event is one of them. My God, thought Case, this is the perfect storm. As a result of this horrible alignment, the bulk of the Sword Fleet, way out by the Flemish Cap, is spared the brunt of the storm, while everyone closer to shore gets pummeled. The 105-foot Mr. Simon, 100 miles west of Albert Johnston, gets her aft door blown in, her wheelhouse flooded, and her anchor fastenings torn off. The anchor starts slamming around on deck, and a crewman has to go out and cut it free. The Lorry Dawn 8 loses her antennas, and then takes a wave down her breather pipes that stuffs one of her engines. Farther south, down the coast, the situation is even worse. A bulk carrier named the Eagle finds herself in serious trouble off the Carolinas, along with a freighter named the Star Baltic, and both struggle into port badly damaged. The 90-foot schooner, Anne Christine, built 123 years ago, sinks off the coast of Delaware, and her crew has to be saved by Coast Guard helicopters. The bulk carrier, Zara, just 50 miles south of the Andrea Gale, takes 90-foot seas over her decks that shear off the steel bolts holding her portholes down. 30 tons of water flood the crew mess, continue into the officers' mess, explode a steel bulkhead, tear through 2 more walls, flood the crew's sleeping quarters, course down a companionway, and kill the ship's engine. The Zara is 550 feet long. And the sailing vessel Satori, alone at the mouth of the Great South Channel, is starting to lose the battle to stay afloat. Karen Stimson crouches miserably by the navigation table and listens to the Tuesday morning NOAA forecast. One of the worst storms since the blizzard of 78. Already 3 dozen boats beached or sunk at Nauset Beach. Ship reports of 63-foot seas, which is probably high, but a sign of problems upcoming. Heavy surf advisory being issued despite temporary lull in the wind field. Instead of abating, as Leonard insisted, the storm just keeps getting worse. The seas are 30 feet and the winds are approaching hurricane force. The boat rolls helplessly on her beam ends every time a wave catches her on the side. We were taking such a hammering, real neck-snapping violence, says Stimson. Things were flying. Every wave was knocking us across the cabin. It was only a matter of time before the boat started to break up. Bylander refuses to go on deck, and Leonard curls up on his bunk, sullen and silent, sneaking gulps off a whiskey bottle. Stimson puts on every piece of clothing she has, climbs the narrow companionway, and clips herself onto the lifeline. No matter what she does, lashing the tiller, running downwind, showing less jib, she can't control the boat. Several times she's snapped to the end of her tether by boarding seas. Stimson knows that if they don't keep their bow to the weather, they'll roll. So she decides they have no choice but to run the engine. She goes below deck to ask Leonard how much fuel they have, but he gives a different answer each time she asks. That's a bad sign for both the fuel level and Leonard's state of mind. But fuel isn't their only problem, Leonard points out. There's also the propeller itself. In such chaotic seas, the prop keeps lifting out of the water and revving too high. Eventually, the bearings will burn out. While Leonard is explaining the subtleties of prop cavitation, the first knockdown occurs. A wave catches the Satori broadsides and puts her mast in the water. The entire crew crashes against the far wall. Canned food rockets across the galley, and water starts pouring into the cabin. At first, Stimson thinks the hull has opened up. A death sentence. But the water has just burst through the main hatch. Debris and splintered glass litter the cabin, and the nav table is drenched. The single sideband is dead, and the VHF looks doubtful. Most of Stimson's experience is with wooden boats. In rough weather, they tend to spring their caulking and sink. Fiberglass is a lot stronger, but it too has limits. Stimson just doesn't know what those limits are. There seems to be no way to keep the boat pointed into the seas, no way to minimize the beating they're taking. Even if the VHF can transmit a mayday, and it's impossible to know that for sure, it only has a range of several miles. They're 50 miles out at sea. Between waves, between slammings, Stimson shouts, I think we should prepare a survival bag, in case we have to abandon ship. Bylander, grateful for something to do, sorts through the wreckage on the floor and stuffs tins of food, bottled water, clothes, and a wired cheese slicer into a sea bag. Sue, we don't need the slicer, We can bite the cheese, Stimson says. But Bylander just shakes her head. I've read about this, and it's the little niceties that make the difference. Ray, where are the boat cushions? While preparing their emergency bag, they get knocked over a second time. This one is even more violent than the first, and the boat is a long time in coming back up. Stimson and Leonard pick themselves off the floor, bruised and dazed, and Bylander sticks her head out the hatch to check for damage on deck. My God, Karen, she screams. The life raft's gone. I was in a corner, and I covered myself with soft things, says Stimson. And with a flashlight, I took about 10 minutes and wrote some goodbyes and stuck it in a Ziploc bag and put it in my clothing. That was the lowest point. We had no contact with anyone. It was the dark of the night, which brings its own kind of terror, and I had a sense that things were going to get worse. But it's a strange thing. There was no sentiment there, no time for fear. To me, fear is 2 a.m., walking down a city street and someone's following me. That, to me, is a terror beyond words. What was happening was not a terror beyond words. It was a grim sense of reality, a scrambling to figure out what to do next, a determination to stay alive and keep other people alive, and an awareness of the dark, noisy slamming of the boat. But it wasn't a terror beyond words. I just had an overwhelming sense of knowing we weren't going to make it. Stimson doesn't know it, but Bylander tapes her passport to her stomach so her body can be identified. Both women, at this point, are prepared to die. After Stimson finishes writing her goodbyes, she tells Leonard that it's time to issue a mayday. Mayday comes from the French, venez m'aider, come help me, and essentially means that those on board have given up all hope. It's up to someone else to save them. Leonard is motionless on his berth. Okay, he says. Stimson forces her way out to the cockpit, and Bylander sits down at the nav table to see if she can coax the VHF back to life. At 11:15 p.m., October 29th, a freighter off Long Island picks up a woman's terrified voice on the VHF. This is the Satori, the Satori. 3949 North and 6952 West. We are three people. This is a mayday. If anyone can hear us, please pass our position on to the Coast Guard. Repeat, this is a mayday. If anyone can hear us, pass our position on to the Coast Guard. The freighter, the Gold Bond Conveyor, relays the message to Coast Guard operations in Boston, which in turn contacts the Coast Guard cutter Tamaroa in Provincetown Harbor. The Tamaroa has just come off George's Bank, where she was conducting spot checks on the fishing fleet, and now she's waiting out the weather inside Cape Cod's huge flexed arm. A small Falcon jet scrambles from Air Station Cape Cod, and the Tamaroa, 1,600 tons and 205 feet, weighs anchor at midnight and heads down the throat of the storm. The crew of the Satori have no way of knowing whether the radio's working. They just have to keep repeating the mayday and hope for the best. And even if the radio is working, they still have to be within 2 or 3 miles of another vessel for the signal to be heard. That's a lot to ask for on a night like this. Bylander, wedged behind the nav table, broadcasts their name and position intermittently for half an hour without any response at all. They're alone out there, as far as she can tell. She keeps trying. What else is there to do? And Stimson goes back on deck to try to keep the Satori pointed into the seas. She's not there long when she hears the sound of an airplane fading in and out through the roar of the storm. She looks around frantically in the darkness, and a minute later, a Falcon jet, flying low under the cloud cover, shrieks overhead and raises Bylander on the VHF. Sue was so excited she was giddy, Stimson says, but I wasn't. I remember not feeling elated or relieved so much as, like, instantly, I'd rejoined the world of the living. The Falcon pilot circles just below cloud level and discusses what to do next over the VHF with Bylander. The Tamaroa won't be there for another 12 hours, and they've got to keep the boat afloat until then, even if that means burning out the engine. They can't afford to risk any more knockdowns. Bylander, against Leonard's wishes, finally toggles the starter switch, and to her amazement, it turns over. With the storm jib up and the prop turning away, they can now get a few degrees to the weather. It's not a lot, but it's enough to keep from getting broached by the seas. Throughout the night, the Falcon pilot flies over them, reassuring Bylander that they're going to come out of this alive. Stimson stays at the helm, and Leonard lies on his bunk, contemplating the impending loss of his boat. When the Tamaroa arrives, he'll have to abandon ship, which is an almost unthinkable act for a captain. The Satori is his home, his life, and if he allows himself to be taken off by the Coast Guard, he'll probably never see her again. Not intact, anyway. At some point that night, lying on his bunk waiting for dawn, Ray Leonard decides he won't get off the boat. The women can leave if they want to, but he'll see the vessel into port. Throughout that night, the Tamaroa slugs her way through the storm. She's a bulldog of a vessel, built to salvage crippled battleships in World War II, and she can tow anything afloat, according to her literature. The sea state is so high, though, that the most she can make is 3 or 4 knots, roughly walking pace. On the larger swells, she plunges into the crest, stalls, and launches out the far side, spray streaming off her bridge and green water sheeting out her scuppers. She crosses Cape Cod Bay, threads the canal, leaves the Elizabeth Islands to starboard, and finally turns the corner around Martha's Vineyard. Commander Lawrence Brudnicki, chief officer on board, estimates that they'll arrive on scene late the next afternoon. The Satori crew has to stay afloat until then. They have no life raft or survival suits on board, and the nearest helicopter base is an hour away. If the Satori goes down, the crew is dead. Brudnicki can't speak directly to the Satori, but he can relay messages via the Falcon that's circling above them. Both ship and plane are also in contact with the First District Command Center in Boston, D1 ComSen, as it's referred to in Coast Guard reports. D1 ComSen is responsible for coordinating all the Coast Guard vessels and aircraft on the rescue and developing the safest strategy for taking the people off the boat. Every decision has to be approved by them. Since the Satori isn't sinking yet, they decide to have the Falcon fly cover until the Tamaroa arrives and then take the crew off by raft. Air rescue in such conditions can be riskier than actually staying with the boat, so it's used as a last resort. As soon as day breaks, the Falcon will be relieved by an H-3 rescue helicopter, and H-3s will fly cover in shifts until the Tamaroa shows up. Helicopters have a limited amount of flying time, generally about 4 hours, but they can pluck people out of the water if need be. Falcon jets can't do much for people in the water except circle them and watch them drown. From the incident log, D1 ComSen. 2:30 a.m., sailing vessel is running out of fuel. Recommend we try to keep Falcon on scene until Tamaroa arrives. 5:29 a.m. Falcon has lost communication with vessel. Vessel is low on battery power and taking on water. Pumps are keeping up, but are run by electric. 7:07 a.m. Falcon on scene. Vessel has been located. 6 hours fuel left. People on board are scared. The H-3 arrives on scene around 6:30 and spends half an hour just trying to locate the Satori. The conditions are so bad that she's vanished from the Falcon's radar, and the H-3 pilot is almost on top of her before spotting her in the foam-streaked seas. The Falcon circles off to the southwest to prepare a life raft drop, while the H-3 takes up a hover directly over the boat. In these conditions, the Falcon pilot could never line up on something as small as a sailboat, so the H-3 acts as a stand-in. The Falcon comes back at 140 knots, radar locked onto the helicopter. And at the last moment, the H-3 falls away and the jet makes the drop. The pilot comes screaming over the Satori's mast, and the co-pilot pushes two life raft packages out a hatch in the floorboards. The rafts are linked by a long nylon tether, and as they fall, they cartwheel apart, splashing down well to either side of the Satori. The tether, released at 200 feet into a hurricane-force wind, drops right into Bylander's hand. The H-3 hovers overhead while the Satori crew haul in the packages, but both rafts have exploded on impact. There's nothing at either end of the line. The Tamaroa is still 5 hours away, and the storm has retrograded to within a couple of hundred miles of the coast. Over the next 24 hours, it will pass directly over the Satori. A daylight rescue in these conditions is difficult, and a nighttime rescue is out of the question. If the Satori crew is not taken off in the next few hours, there's a good chance they won't be taken off at all. Late that morning, the second H-3 arrives, and the pilot, Lieutenant Clausen, explains the situation to Ray Leonard. Leonard radios back that he's not leaving the boat. It's unclear whether Leonard is serious or just trying to save face. Either way, the Coast Guard is having none of it. Two helicopters, two Falcon jets, a medium-range cutter, and 100 air and seamen have already been committed to the rescue. The Satori crew are coming off now. Owner refuses to leave and says he sailed through hurricanes before. The ComSen incident log records at 12:24 that afternoon. Tamaroa wants manifestly unsafe voyage so that owner-operator can be forced off. A manifestly unsafe voyage means that the vessel has been deemed an unacceptable risk to her crew or others, and the Coast Guard has the legal authority to order everyone off. Commander Brudnicki gets on the radio with District 1 and requests a manifestly unsafe designation for the Satori. And at 12:47, it's granted. The Tamaroa is just a couple